It's Monday, March 29th, 2021. I'm Tanya Harris, and welcome to TMI Daily, your daily roundup of everything people are talking about online since they aren't allowed to talk about it in person. The trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin began today with both the prosecution and defense giving opening statements. This comes as a great shock to anyone who watched the video of Chauvin killing George Floyd, since we all thought there could be no defense for it. After nearly a week blocking all traffic from flowing through the Suez Canal, the giant cargo ship Ever Given is finally moving again. This is a big moment for Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, as he now goes back to being the biggest cause of needless obstruction on earth. Dr. Deborah Birx said in a CNN interview that after the first 100 COVID deaths, most deaths related to the virus, quote, could have been mitigated or decreased substantially. If only there had been someone like maybe a doctor or something who could have stood up to the former president and made him understand this. Right, Deborah? In his Palm Sunday address, Pope Francis warned that the devil is taking advantage of the COVID-19 crisis. I guess no one realized that Satan was a big shareholder in Amazon. Speaking of Satan, Nike has denied involvement in making Lil Nas X's new Satan shoes that contain a drop of human blood. Sure, the average Nike sneaker contains the sweat and tears of low-paid foreign workers, but any blood in them is completely unintentional. Although the cable home of the New York Knicks and Rangers, MSG Network, is being purchased for $900 million, it will still be run by the Dolan family, who owns both teams. No word yet on how soon the network's play-by-play commentators will request to be traded to a sports network more committed to winning. The MLB Players Association said that they would discuss moving this year's All-Star Game out of Atlanta due to Georgia's new voting restriction legislation. Georgia politicians are shocked that the Players Association might vote to do this, since they were pretty sure they successfully took away brown and black people's ability to vote last week. San Diego Comic-Con is moving to Thanksgiving weekend this year, just in case you want to spend the holiday fighting over the finer points of Zack Snyder's Justice League with some rando dude dressed up as Wonder Woman, instead of arguing about the crisis at the border with your racist uncle. On TikTok, Lori Loughlin's daughter Olivia Jade said she learned an inspirational lesson about public shaming from the college admission scandal, and that her pain can be valid without invalidating others' concerns. That would actually make a decent college admissions essay. Between that and a $250,000 payoff, she could probably get herself into a top school. Comedian Ron Funches will host Chopped 420, a new spinoff of the Food Network Chopped competition show, where chefs will be judged on how well they cook dishes with cannabis in them. One thing is for certain, no matter how the food is prepared, everyone eating it will wind up baked. Oh, and the network hopes the ratings are high, like the judges. Okay, enough. Now, let's send it over to tonight's TMI Daily cast and crew roundtable. Stay safe.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to an all-new week of TMI Daily. I'm Veronica Aiello, and as always, I'm joined by some of my TMI Daily crew, more specifically, half of my TMI Daily crew. Let's go around and say hello to everyone watching at home or listening to our podcast. Let's start with you, Pete.
I don't know where the hell everybody is. I'm so confused.
Joe.
Hi, everyone listening on Google Podcasts, and a very happy National Mom and Pop Business Day. And if any of you were expecting a nice somebody here to like counteract the really, really awful humor of Pete and I, sorry.
Suck it.
Yeah, and it's not going to be me either. So.
Later, you know, on. You know how you like to have a glass of milk standing by when you eat something really, really spicy? That milk's gone, yo.
Joe, before we get started with tonight's show, do you want to clarify the whole thing that's happening with San Diego Comic-Con?
You know, they keep
saying could you kill
San Diego
about
Comic-Con.
12 minutes of this?
Hold it, hold it. They keep saying San Diego Comic-Con is going to be in November. It is not. San Diego Comic-Con is not scheduled till next year, 2022. Now, the people that organize Comic-Con are putting up a very small event in November. Let's call this event, we gotta practice all of the procedures we're going to need for next year. So it's going to be a very small event. I don't know how many people are going to get in, but not many. But it's basically going to be sort of like a dry run weekend in November around Thanksgiving time. But it is not, let me repeat, it is not San Diego Comic-Con. San Diego Comic-Con is not coming back until 2022. It'll be back in July the way it always is, and it'll be big and fun and exciting, and we'll all be vaccinated, and we'll all have to figure out really great cosplays that we're going to have to wear with a mask. I'm thinking maybe Sub-Zero from like Mortal Kombat. That'd be really cool. You know, like, or you could be like Bane from Batman or something like that, but something, you know, where you can mask up, because hey, we normally get con crud, but can you imagine getting con crud and COVID? Like COVID crud? Holy crap. Anyway.
Joe, you think Comic-Con's you can elaborate on this for like 15 more minutes?
What?
Can you elaborate on this for like 15 more minutes?
No, I'm just, it annoys me because Comic-Con even had to put out a tweet. It's like, yo, stop. All the media outlets, stop. Like they said the thing, and they're still like, Comic-Con's happening in November. No, it's not. Shut up. And then like half the nerds are like spreading it. I'm like, Jesus, I'm surprised the nerds are spreading this because they usually read. So I don't know. It's not happening in November, guys. Comic-Con's happening next year. Hopefully WonderCon is happening next year too, because this week would normally be like WonderCon week coming up, and I'd be all excited and making costumes and shit. So, but it's not happening either. So, hey.
So you're saying, so let's just clarify this point. So you're saying that it's not happening this year, that there's something else happening that is like a dry run for next year is what you're saying.
That is right. It does not have a name yet. It does not have like there's no information on it other than knowing that they're doing a very small event in November, and they announced this back in January. So I don't know why this is fucking news now. But listen, it's not Comic-Con. It's not going to be anywhere near what Comic-Con is. What?
When I read it this morning, it sounded like Comic-Con.
It is not Comic-Con.
I didn't read it that well. So
it is not Comic-Con. Comic-Con has even said, Comic-Con themselves have said, what's happening in November is not Comic-Con. Quit saying it.
As so Philip is saying the attendees are basically the seat fillers.
Well, if that, I mean, I doubt there's going to be a ton of people there. I mean, they're obviously going to be doing the convention center and probably nothing out. Like normally Comic-Con takes up the entire downtown of the city. So probably it's going to stay within the convention center, probably not even going to be the whole convention center. And probably more than likely what they're doing with this is kind of like I said, you know, the same way that like they're doing the food festivals at the theme park. It's their way of testing things so that they can be, you know, safely social distance or whatnot or whatever they have to do to make the con a safer event. So this is probably a dry run test kind of thing.
Okay.
And so I don't know about the tickets or anything like that, but don't go and buy a ticket for November thinking you're going to go down there and see Comic-Con. You're not. It's not going to be that huge.
That would be totally wrong.
You'll be totally disappointed. But now this is Pete's chance to really go and see it without all the people.
So you heard it here on TMI Daily. We just clarified.
Well, yeah, I heard you. We got it from Comic-Con. But listen, I want to be on Comic-Con's good side. Maybe they'll be, you know, maybe they'll be a partner with us for me telling you what they said. November's not Comic-Con.
Okay.
So if you're coming from so Holland or Denmark and Pakistan, if you're coming out here in November, don't come for Comic-Con. Wait till next July if you're coming for Comic-Con.
Don't come.
Hold on, your costumes. Don't bring your costume.
Yeah, well, you can bring a costume. I don't know. Probably, I don't know how. They're probably going to limit the cosplay, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So later on in the show, we're also going to be joined by our friend Justin Baker. We're going to talk to him about what he's been up to this past year and also about his new podcast, Just in Conversation. So make sure you stay tuned for that.
Maybe he'll want to talk about Comic-Con with us.
Well, he might. I mean, what he does on his show sort of relays into that in different ways. So I know. See, even Burbank is like, that's not Comic-Con.
It's not Comic-Con. We now understand.
Hashtag not Comic-Con.
Not Comic-Con.
Okay, let's start tonight's show.
Really?
So last year on Memorial Day, Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was filmed applying a knee to the back and neck of George Floyd after police responded to a call of someone passing a counterfeit $20 bill at a convenience store. Within the almost 9.5 minute video, Chauvin is seen holding Floyd down while he pleads to be released because he cannot breathe. The video ends with Chauvin on top of Floyd for well over 1 minute after he goes limp and becomes unresponsive. Tonight, we thought we would look at the opening statements by both the prosecution and the defense to get a preview on how each side plans to try this case. So before we go forward, today in the trial, the prosecution played a 9-minute and 29-second video of Derek Chauvin restraining George Floyd. This was longer than the 8.5-minute video most of us saw last year. So, Pete, Joe, did you guys see the video today? And if so, how would you describe the difference between what we saw today and what we saw last year? Pete, let's start with you.
Well, I actually, as much as I hated to see it, I did watch the whole 9-minute and 30-second video. And it's just, you know, like when we saw the video that most of us saw last summer was pretty much from the time that Chauvin put his knee on George Floyd's neck and back up until the point where he had passed out. What the extra part of the video showed was another like almost 2 minutes of him still on top of him while he's completely unresponsive. Like it shows an ambulance worker coming over, checking, finding out that he has no pulse, walking away, and Chauvin never taking his knee off of his neck and back, regardless of this. So they were, I mean, he even is kind of told there is no pulse and still didn't take his knee off of George Floyd's back and neck. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. And so watching it, it's really horrifying because, you know, again, seeing it the way we saw last year was pretty horrifying, but knowing that this went on for well over a minute after he was probably either dead or at the precipice of being dead, it's just awful.
Mm-hmm. Joe, did you watch the video or no, the full video today?
I haven't had the heart to. No. I've been keeping up on the trial, but I can't. It's disturbing and it's tough for me to watch.
Same way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't watch the whole video today either when they were showing it. So prosecutor Jerry Blackwell was the first to speak. Here is some of what he said.
The most important numbers you will hear in this trial are 9-2-9. What happened in those 9 minutes and 29 seconds when Mr. Derek Chauvin was applying this excessive force to the body of Mr. George Floyd? And you will be able to hear Mr. Floyd saying, "Please, I can't breathe. Please, man, please." In this 9 minutes and 29 seconds, you will see that as Mr. Floyd is handcuffed there on the ground, he is verbalizing 27 times, you will hear. In the 4 minutes and 45 seconds, "I can't breathe. Please, I can't breathe." You will see that Mr. Chauvin is kneeling on Mr. Floyd's neck and back. You will hear his final words when he says, "I can't breathe." Before that time, you'll hear his voice get heavier. You will hear his words further apart. You will see that his respiration gets shallower and shallower and finally stops when he speaks his last words, "I can't breathe." So we learn here that Mr. Floyd at some point is completely passed out. Mr. Chauvin continues on as he had, knee on the neck, knee on the back. You'll see he does not let up and he does not get up. For the remaining, as you can see, 3 minutes and 51 seconds. During this period of time, you will learn that Mr. Chauvin is told that they can't even find the pulse of Mr. Floyd. You learn he's told that twice. They can't even find the pulse. You will learn about something in this case called an anoxic seizure. It is the body's automatic reflex when breathing has stopped due to oxygen deprivation. We'll be able to point out to you when you'll see the involuntary movements from Mr. Floyd that are part of an anoxic seizure. Not only that, you're going to learn about something that's called agonal breathing. When the heart has stopped, when blood is no longer coursing through the veins, you will hear the body gasp as an involuntary reflex. We'll point out to you when Mr. Floyd is having the agonal breathing, again, as a reflex. You're also going to hear and see certain evidence of what this was not. This was, for example, not a fatal heart event. This was not, for example, a heart attack. We're going to ask at the end of this case that you find Mr. Chauvin guilty for his excessive use of force against George Floyd. We're going to ask that you find him guilty of murder in the second degree, murder in the third degree, and second degree manslaughter.
Prosecution is completely relying on the jury to find Chauvin guilty based on the video evidence. Now, none of us here on the panel are legal experts, so instead, I would ask you to be a juror for a moment. Is the video enough evidence for you to vote to convict? I'll start. Yes, I do. I think it is. Pete, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, in a normal world, in a sane world, you would think, yes, that would be the thing that all you need to do is say, look at this video. But we're not living in a sane world, nor are we living in a fair world. The video is only going to tell one part of the story. And when it comes down to it, the lawyers are going to try and pick it apart. They're going to say that every time he lifted his arm, he was resisting. And they'll have experts that'll say that versus experts that are going to say that the reason why he was lifting his arm up was because it was the only way for him to get air at that point, because the other side of his body was being suffocated. But again, Chauvin's defense is going to be he was a cop, and this man was still posing some kind of threat. And so, no, the video evidence isn't going to be enough. I mean, the problem that you're going to have more than anything else here is that there's only three ways anybody ended up on this jury. Way number one is if you are very pro George Floyd and you want to see justice be done for him. Number two is if you're very pro the police and nothing that a police officer does is ever going to be considered wrong. And number three is that you somehow or another are so completely so completely void of any idea of what's going on that, like, for a month last summer, you never once said to yourself, I wonder why they're burning down our city, because they had to get 12 people that they said did not have, like, a real opinion one way or the other of this case. In fact, one of the people said that one of the people on the jury said that they actually hadn't even seen the video, that they'd seen just pictures of it, which again leads me to wonder what kind of person is that ends up on a jury. So no, the video is not going to be nearly enough. And they got to hope that over the course of time, that their medical experts are better than the medical experts that Chauvin's team is going to come out with. And that's what it's really going to come down to.
Yeah. Sad, but true. Joe, did you want to add anything to this?
I was watching the highlights from the trial today. It's day one. And I'm already sitting there going, this is going to be such an uphill battle for the prosecution. Even with that video and things like that, it is just, especially when we start getting to the autopsy stuff. I mean, it's going to be expert versus expert and stuff like that. But I think it's just, I really think it's going to be a rough road. I think part of it is what Pete said. I think it's going to be tough to find a jury that's not going to, that's going to go the prosecution's way. And then secondly, I mean, just the way the defense is already setting their argument, they know where they're going with this case. And I don't know. I would, I mean, of course, we'd all want to see a conviction here. I just I'm already a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think it's going to happen.
So you just mentioned the defense, and that's a good segue for our next clip that we're going to show. After Black Pulse opening statement, Chauvin's defense attorney Eric Nelson took his turn at the opening statement. Let's take a look.
What was Mr. Floyd's actual cause of death? The evidence will show that Mr. Floyd died of a cardiac arrhythmia that occurred as a result of hypertension, his coronary disease, the ingestion of methamphetamine and fentanyl, and the adrenaline flowing through his body, all of which acted to further compromise an already compromised heart. The evidence will show that when confronted by police, Mr. Floyd put drugs in his mouth in an effort to conceal them from the police. When you see these videos pulled back from afar, you will be able to see the Minneapolis police squad car rocking back and forth during this struggle.
So much so that it catches the attention of the 911 dispatcher, Jenna Scurry. This was not an easy struggle. They're called names. You heard them this morning. A f***ing bum. They're screaming at him, causing the officers to divert their attention from the care of Mr. Floyd to the threat that was growing in front of them. And you will learn that Derek Chauvin did exactly what he had been trained to do over the course of his 19-year career. The use of force is not attractive, but it is a necessary component of policing. But when you review the actual evidence, and when you hear the law and apply reason and common sense, there will only be one just verdict, and that is to find Mr. Chauvin not guilty.
I have two questions that I want to ask you guys about Nelson's defense. And the first one has to do with something that I have an issue with, which is victim blaming. Is there any way he can defend Derek Chauvin without putting George Floyd's life on trial, including his past criminal offenses and his health issues?
No. I mean, how can he? I mean, you know, the thing is, and here's the part that probably makes most people angry, but it's just the way it is. If he didn't do these things, if he didn't make George Floyd to be the villain in this for his clients, you know, even if Chauvin's found guilty, a judge will overturn it and give him another trial down the road, because you have to put on as vigorous a defense as possible. And in this case, as heinous as the defense is going to be, and as heinous as it sounds, this is the right decision. I mean, you have to go this way. I mean, it sounds terrible, because when you think about it in terms of like what common sense tells you, he's essentially saying that it's kind of like somebody who got killed by a drunk driver. Well, they also had coronary heart disease, so they were going to die anyway. So you should just realize that, you know, it wasn't the drunk driver that killed him. It was the fact that, you know, he smoked too much, drank too much, whatever it was. And this is what killed him. But that's the way to defend the indefensible. You have to do it. And it's a terrible, terrible thing to do, but yeah, I mean, and they're going to have enough reason, because the judge apparently already allowed them to bring into evidence, George Floyd was arrested in 2019 for drugs, and so they're going to allow him to bring that into evidence. They're going to allow George Floyd to be the one on trial. And again, it's going to sound heinous to most of us, but at the end of the day, this is how you win a case. And if he wasn't trying to win the case, they'd find a reason to give Chauvin a second shot at this if he loses.
Mm-hmm. Joe, anything you want to add to that?
Oh, obviously. I mean, one of the big things is going to be the medical thing. I don't want to call myself a cardiac expert, but I have cardiac problems. Some of them are similar to what George Floyd has. And I don't like it's going to be, I don't know who they're going to get to, because it's going to be a tough, it to me, it's going to be a tough road to go from what George Floyd had to, you know, blaming that for what happened to him. Because I know when you have a cardiac arrhythmia, I know exactly what happens. I know exactly what is the, what are the not just the symptoms, but what ends up happening and things like that. I mean, other things would have happened first before he would have had his cardiac arrest that they're saying he had. So, I mean, that's what makes me sick. But I mean, of course, you're going to, just like every case, you're going to find a doctor that's going to go for him. And then I hope the prosecution finds a doctor that goes against it. But it still goes down to 12 people that know nothing about medicine listening to this and trying to figure it out.
Yeah. So I know in this country, everyone has the right to a competent defense in court. So why do so many people make the defense attorney out to be a villain? That's something that Pete and I were talking about earlier today. And, you know, yes, everyone has a right to, to defense. But I just think there's just certain cases. This isn't like your traditional, like he said, she said, there's a little bit of evidence here and there. I mean, I think for me personally, I mean, the video just speaks volumes. I mean, you're watching a murder happen as it's happening, and whether it was, you know, 8 minutes or whatever, 30 seconds or 9 minutes, every second is, you know, you have somebody's life in your hands and you're doing absolutely nothing about it. I just, to me, in this particular case, I don't know. It's a tough one. It's really tough. Joe.
You know, that's the whole thing. And, you know, they're put across as a villain, but in the long run, now listen to me, because I know some people are going to balk when they hear this, but I'm like, but in the long run, actually, they're not. They're actually kind of, in a way, a hero. Because think about the amount of defense attorneys that wouldn't even touch his case, that wouldn't even take it. But by far, he has a right to a defense, and he has a right to a defense attorney. And that's a defense attorney's job. Now, whatever he feels personally about it, he has to put that all aside and do this. And the fact that he's taking up on it, it seems like a huge insurmountable hill. Now, sometimes defense attorneys want to take this because, you know, it'll help boost them career wise and things like that. But you got to remember that that's their job. If you've ever watched a Bridge of Spies, where Tom Hanks has to take on the defense of that Russian, and Everyone's like, "What the hell are you doing?" He's a Russian spy. But it's the same kind of thing. By the way that we're set up here in the United States in our legal justice system, he has a right to a defense, and he has a right to a competent defense. So I think it's wrong to call them like the evil or the bad guy or things like that. They are doing their job. And to me, I think it's, you know, whatever you want to say about it, I think it's kind of courageous in a way to take it on when you know everybody in America is kind of against you. You know, whatever happens to him in the long run, who knows? But I mean, someone had to do it. You know, someone had to do it. Yeah. And so, hey, you know, best of luck to him.
Pete?
Yeah, I mean, exactly what Joe's saying. And far be it for me to say, oh, you know, what a great thing it is that you're defending this guy, because it's not. It's definitely not a great thing. But this is a fairly courageous thing to have to do, because this isn't the kind of case like let's use a perfect example, like the OJ case, like when he had that plethora of top name lawyers working for him, where it's such a high profile case. And if you get him off, you're probably going to get a ton of cases, you know, similar in the sense of you're going to get celebrity cases. There's no celebrity in Derek Chauvin. Derek Chauvin is a villain no matter how you go about this. And so the fact that anybody took on the case, you know, somebody was going to do it one way or the other, exactly like Joe said. But the fact that somebody is doing it doesn't make them a bad person. It just makes them doing their job. And when they sign on to be lawyers, it's kind of part and parcel of what you end up having to do as a lawyer, especially if you're a defense attorney. You will defend people that are indefensible, yeah. You know, and so that's the terrible part about this. And again, you know, I feel bad in a sense because, like, I don't want to sound like I'm in pro the defense lawyer. But at the same time, there's going to be people that are going to definitely make death threats to him, to his family, and, you know, and to people in his life. And he's going to have to deal with a lot of this. And it's not his fault. You know, he didn't do anything wrong.
I just finished a book, Mindhunters, which is the book that they based the series on Netflix. But it's essentially about the setting up of the FBI profiling. And basically, it deals about serial killers. Every single one of those serial killers had to have a defense lawyer. And I mean, think about it, it was that same kind of thing. Do you think that was easy for them? Everybody's already pretty much said, oh, my gosh, this guy's a serial killer. And now you're defending him. It's that same kind of thing. But that's a person's job. I mean, one of the movie that I really like is Spotlight. And that's the same thing again. They talk about how, oh, these guys are just, you know, these guys are scumbags. No, they're not. They're doing their job. They may not like it. And you have to put your personal feelings aside. It's that same kind of thing that, like, if, you know, during war or something like that, if the enemy came in wounded, the doctor would still work on them. Because you got to put that aside and do what you're supposed to do.
Part of the
and
job.
It's that same kind of thing. Like if good or bad, if someone comes into the hospital, a doctor's going to work on them. And that's the same thing. You got to put your personal feelings aside on it. I hope people aren't going to, you know, the general public aren't going to take it that way, but that's the case.
No, and I agree with you 100%. It's just like, you know, in certain cases, it's just a really hard pill to swallow, but that's just the way it is, you know?
I wish the officers had that same mindset. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be here.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
So again, none of us here are legal experts, like I said earlier in the show. And I don't want to ask you guys how you think this is going to end up in court, or because if not, it would just be speculation on our part. So instead,
I'll speculate.
Okay, so I want to ask my final question. Let's take both scenarios. Chauvin is convicted of second-degree murder, or he's found innocent of the most serious charges. How do you think people are going to react in either case? Final question.
Well, listen, if he's innocent, there's going to be stuff happening. Whether we have something that's more calm, like the Black Lives Matters protest, like that we had, or if there's going to be some major rioting, especially in Minneapolis and things like that, that I don't know, but there will be some sort of backlash. Mm-hmm. The other way around, I mean, if he gets a second degree, then people are at least going to be able to say, hey, you know, at least they did something if something happened, you know, and then we go from there. But yes, definitely, I think. You'll see. I mean, this is far from it's. We talked about this last year, and we said everything is great that there's this movement, that the Black Lives Matter movement happens, stuff like that. We are at the very, 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 very beginning of this very, very long road. So, you know.
Yeah. Any final comments, Pete? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people should start understanding that there's a really good chance that, regardless of what we all saw in that video, that this guy's going to get off, because it is really hard to convict a cop. It's statistically nearly impossible in most cases, even in the cases where it seems so obvious to happen. But the problem is going to be that, you know, the prosecution has second degree murder, third degree murder, and manslaughter charges as possible verdicts. So there's a good possibility he may get found guilty of something, but maybe not the worst case scenario. And I think that the problem we're going to see is that there's people are so amped up at this point that, regardless of anything, unless he gets everything thrown at him, there's still going to be problems. And it does not help a cause when people start rioting. It doesn't help a cause when people start looting. And those are all part and parcel of what happened last summer and will happen again this summer, it will happen in a month from now if the wrong verdict comes down. And I think people just should be prepared for the idea that the wrong verdict very well possibly could come down. Hopefully it won't, but they should be ready and prepared for it. And it's not going to affect just Minneapolis. It's going to affect every city. If you're watching us here in LA, if you're in New York, if you're in Kentucky, I don't know why anybody in Kentucky is watching us, but if they were. But it's going to affect everywhere because if the strongest possible verdict is not found to be the verdict, then it's going to end in protests, and some of those protests are going to turn into the things we don't want to see.
Oh, and we love you, Kentucky. We're glad that you're listening to us.
Yes,
you know, and don't think that because we're in LA that we're once bitten, twice shy. Something is going to happen, guys.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's bring Justin on. According to our guest tonight, we were born to be creators, explorers, dreamers, and thinkers. Lately, it seems we've lost our connection to our world, to our friends, to the things that we love, and perhaps even to ourselves. Our guest tonight, Justin Baker, explores thought-provoking topics each week on this mysterious journey of life on his podcast, Just in Conversation. Please welcome Justin Baker. Hi, Justin. How are you?
Hey guys, it's good to see you again.
I know, good to see you too. We haven't seen you in so long.
I know, more than a year.
It's been I think the last time I saw you, we were having drinks at Worst House, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Oh my God, you guys remember having drinks?
I know.
The good old days.
Yeah, right. The pre times, before times.
Yeah. So Justin, we've known each other now for a few years now. So do you mind telling our audience what your background is?
Yeah. I'll try not to go too long about that, but
Oh, you can't. We have a lot of time to stretch, so you're good.
Okay.
usually more people join us. For some reason, not as many people here today. So you go on as long as you want.
They heard I was coming. That's what it is. Sorry. So I actually I started off in life as a musician. I mean, I'm still one. But I went through the path of music. I got a music degree in vocal performance, so classical singing and that kind of thing. And I ended up teaching music at a public high school for many years. And that was back, I grew up in Charleston, South Carolina. That's where I grew up and from. And that led to just a teaching career of all sorts of things, into the arts and then theater and eventually film and TV, and a little bit of radio. So it's funny how you end up doing different things, but I ended up really loving the film world. And so I quit the teaching job and did the whole LA dream and moved across the country, came out here to see how I could do that. And eventually got some, you know, PA jobs and kind of worked my way up in film and TV, and did that for a few years. But in the kind of the back of my mind, I've always wanted to create my own content, and I wanted to kind of capture stories. And my sort of creative film journey, originally, like everybody else, was a screenplay or doing kind of artsy films. But what I realized is the true to life stories that we've seen in the past hour are a lot more interesting and a lot more engaging. So I found real people's story to be a little bit more interesting. So I kind of went to the documentary route in the form of just telling people stories or interviewing or just creating content that was about real life. So that led me to create my own company. And I just wanted to kind of find what people's stories were and figure out a way to tell them in a meaningful way, which led me down the path of social media. So I got a certification in social media creative development and management and started one by one getting some clientele to help manage and tell stories through social media. And this was quite a while ago when social media was really kind of taking on and everybody started realizing they needed to be on there and that kind of thing. And we've had similar conversations about all this. And eventually it kind of led its own path into where things were needed. And just by kind of word of mouth in Los Angeles in particular, I had sort of a need to help public figures tell their story. And that included voice actors or programming, or I even work with the Episcopal Church here in Los Angeles and helping ministers and just people that have a platform that need some guidance on how to use the platforms for a meaningful way. So I run a company, and it's a media company, and mostly we do social media management and creative structures, and then also, because of my film and music background, I do a lot of kind of just creation. So I've directed music videos for clients, start to finish video projects, things like that. So, and now I have this podcast, which has nothing to do with any of that, but here we are.
But you've added podcast hosts now to your resume. So,
oh yeah. It's funny because when I was a kid, I was such a, probably like many of us here, I was such a nerd, such a geek. But I remember I have a strange story about, like, you know, pretending and doing things. And I pretended to do all the things I've already done. So the first thing is I pretended to be a teacher. I ended up being a teacher. And then I would end up trying to pretend to be like a store clerk. And I worked at Best Buy for like 10 years. I remember taking like one of those shelf system boom boxes and hooking it up in a way that I could kind of make my own little radio show. And my poor brother, he was like the guy that had to do all the stuff. So he had to be the guy interviewed. He had to be the assistant actor. He had to be all these other things. So that kind of led me to the kind of the magic of what you can do with audio too. And so I would say I do have a little bit of life experience just playing as a kid. And so now I get to use like the real equipment. So that part is totally fun. But to revisit that again as an adult in a meaningful way has been an interesting journey for me the past couple of months.
So your podcast, you started it 2 months ago, and it's called Just in Conversation, by the way. Excellent play on words. I love what you do with the title.
Thank you.
So can you tell us a little bit more in depth about the podcast and what led you to actually start doing it?
Yeah. Well, it's sort of a long thought process in the making, actually. I did launch it a few months ago, but it's been a really kind of a couple of years. And I've always wanted to launch a podcast, but I didn't want to just do one to do one. And as a social media manager, I'm kind of aware of all the trends and what, where to be and all the platforms, and podcasting was where it was at. I mean, everybody should be doing a podcast. So I felt the pressure a little bit, but I was kind of like, eh, okay, what am I going to talk about? You know, what, do people even want to hear what I have to say? What's going on with that? So I've been sitting on this idea for a long time, and I've kind of, all right, we're going to start it. And then I didn't, oh, I'm going to start it. And I didn't, I just didn't really have any motivational drive behind it or purpose. And I do have to give a little nod to, I know you love the name Justin Conversation, and I do too. The idea actually came to me from a really great friend of mine named David Castillo. He's an opera singer here in Los Angeles. And we were just having drinks one night and discussing the name of the podcast. And he jokingly said, what about Justin Conversation, using your name? And we all laughed about it. And then I was like, wait a minute, that's actually really cool. So years later, when I decided to come up with it, I texted him. I was like, hey, can I steal your idea? And he's like, sure, of course. So that's how that came to be. So this podcast came out of a necessity for a personal connection again. So as most of us have had some sort of loss or disconnection over the past year with being isolated, some of us more than others, I started to see a lot of my community groups that I would belong to, kind of one by one, the light went out. You know, we're shutting down. Everybody gets that email or that phone call. We're closing, we're closing, we're closing. So that anxiety of feeling that in this kind of emergency situation, over time of you know, a couple of weeks, I started to see the communities that I daily connect with just kind of vanish. And along with that, some of the friendships I had didn't survive. We've all had true losses as well. So that all of that combined really had an effect on me. So I felt a really big kind of just disconnect from everything, from the earth, from the world, from friends, from communities, and I was kind of lost. So I was, I got a therapist and, kind of started talking through things, which I highly recommend for anybody. Mental health is super important, especially in times like this. And I was kind of just doing some meditation, which was a new thing for me to do. And I was kind of thinking and racking my brain about how do I desperately, I needed to connect again. And, you know, my soul searching led me to the answers of, you know, you probably are connected more than you think you are in some way. So I started to kind of dig back. When did I feel connected the most in my life? And I went back and kind of went in the Rolodex of my head of friendships I used to have, and times when I felt super connected and super genuine and just had some happiness in my life with other people and things. And a lot of those times were times of years ago or in my childhood or when times were simpler, when fear was not in the forefront of stuff. And not just the virus, but I think we've had a very, very tough last few years for all kinds of reasons. So fear and not knowing what's happening and, you know, threatening of loss has been there for a long time. And so that takes a toll. And so you begin to think that this world that you're living in is not doing it for you. You need something else. And so I decided to go back to a time when I remembered when things actually were pretty great. And when I did that exercise, and I actually call it connecting the dots, which is the name of my first episode. I sometimes will do a project where I will look at everything that's great in my life. I'll make a list and connect dots to how did that occur? What connection did I make to make this happen? And I keep connecting those paths all the way back. And when you do that, you start to remember, oh yeah, that person and that person that played a role in my life, or that person that gave me some money to help this endeavor, or this person that did me a favor, or this person that talked to somebody else, or this person that spent a few hours with me one night talking to me. So when I did that exercise, I made a list of all these people in my childhood or teenage years or college that really had an impact on me. And I said, you know, I'd like to reconnect with these people because some of them I haven't talked to in 20 years. And I bet if I called them on the phone, it'd be a little weird. So, but I bet they would do a podcast episode. So the idea kind of all came to me at once, truly just out of a need to talk to somebody again at length. So I just started reaching out to old friends that I haven't talked to in decades. And I said, hey, I'm doing this new thing, a podcast where we reconnect. Do you want to be on? And they're like, yeah, let's do it. So I've released a few episodes already. And they've really been, it's been a lot more of a great experience than I expected for both of us. I've gotten from everybody that it's been on so far, they've written back and said, man, that was so great just to reconnect again. And also just to tell your story or to remember things that you'd forgotten about. So it's this season is all about connecting the dots and connecting back to good memories and people and friendships that you kind of forgotten about.
I love that. That's so powerful and that's so wonderful. So we did go through some of your episodes and, you know, Pete and I did, and we noticed a recurring theme, and that recurring theme is that people grow up with one idea about how life is going to be, but over time they're either knowingly or unconsciously forced to change their perspective. Mm. Why do you think that is? Is that fair to say that you've noticed this with some of your episodes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I just listened to another talk, and it was about this kind of fear of aging. And when the person that was talking was going to share an example, I thought they were going to use the example of somebody older. But the person they used as an example was someone that was just turning 30 with this fear of aging. And, you know, that is very valid. And there are a lot of studies and evidence right now that adults in their 20s are really experiencing a major fear of aging and what they're missing out on. And you know, I'm from the generation where social media didn't exist when I was a teenager or even in college. So you had to create experiences that were in the now, and then you write about them or you call someone or you have a conversation or you have an experience about them. Everything isn't kind of just laid out for you. And I think there's pros and cons, which I'd also talk about on these episodes. But I think everybody has this kind of FOMO, what we call it. You know, there's a, there is this idea of, did I miss my opportunity? Did the ship pass already? What am I losing? And it's not what you expected. This podcast that I made was sort of my lifesaver. It was like, I have to create meaning out of what's happening right now. And so I need to know if other people are also experiencing this. So these ideas that you have, as these kind of wanderlust ideas, which is a theme of the podcast, is looking back to nostalgic ideas or things. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily work out the way that you thought they would, but it's not a negative angle. It is something else occurred that you can exist in the now. And so, you know, I think the last episode I just released, I talked about how I'm experiencing myself trying to exist in this time with this body at this age and not some other fantasy that I've thought might happen. So, you know, every episode starts with a monologue of myself and how I've kind of, what I've taken out of the interview and use it as an excuse to kind of give out some thoughts about what it made me feel. And I've heard from some people that's kind of their favorite part. So, I tried to keep that in there, but what it's actually done for myself is it's helped me to do the work to think through these ideas and to do the work to connect to people on a true level. And really do some work on the inside to ask these questions that we're thinking and not necessarily get answers, but talk through them and go through them in this time and not wish that we were in some other reality.
Yeah. And, you know, and connections really are so important. And I think that's something that we all have learned, you know, especially this past year. And yeah. I just think it's so great what you're doing, Justin.
Thank you.
Let's open it up to Joe and Pete. Do you guys have any questions for Justin? Pete, let's start with you.
Hey, Justin, it's good to see you.
Hey, Pete.
Even if it's remotely, it's really good.
To see you.
I mean, obviously, you know, your background is in doing something with people in entertainment, and it's not usually considered to be a business full of really, how would I put this in the best way, non-vain people, I guess. And you're doing something that seems to have a lot of substance. How is it to, how do you kind of like juggle the two different worlds in a sense? Because you've got one world where, you know, it's so, at the end of the day, it's so inconsequential in a way. And on the other side, you're talking about issues that are so heavy and very, you know, and very prescient to everything that's going on in our world.
That's an interesting question. I would actually argue that they're very much the same. And they're very connected. You know, my connection to entertainment is very limited into the clientele that I work with. And as I've previously said, they're mostly voice actors. And I can kind of say, I can say this a little bit. I just won't say who I work with. But I mostly work with a lot of cartoon actors. And one of them, I can say, Carlos Alazraki, you guys know him. You worked with him on TMI. And, you know, what I've experienced actually is it's the conduit through which you are experiencing the world. And for many people, and I don't know if you've listened to the Glowing in the Dark episode.
I think that was the one I think I listened to for the most time, actually, earlier today. I had it playing while I was working on
yeah, that's one of my favorite episodes because I talk about this idea of superheroes. Yeah. And how we all have something that we really, really connect to that is obviously not of this world. So for some, you know, Comic-Con is a great example where people follow along in this storytelling idea of comic books. And now, of course, it's opened up to movies and television and books or whatever. I mean, Harry Potter is another example where you have these really well-written worlds that are now created that people find themselves in. And they can experience the real world through this kind of filter of whatever characters have been written. So for many people that experience the world through that, even through a video game, it can be extremely meaningful for a fan of something to reconnect to life in that way. I mean, I can give an example that I'm glad you're giving me this an excuse to talk about Star Trek. But
yeah, that's exactly why I asked the question.
Yeah, exactly. I am a self-proclaimed Star Trek nerd, and I often will say that to every issue that we talk about, there's a Star Trek episode about it. And you know, I was going through an illness in college many years ago, and I had to stay home a lot, and I really couldn't go out much. And there was this, again, this idea of fear and anxiety and not knowing what's going to happen. Is my life going to change forever? And I remember watching this episode of Star Trek Voyager. And at that time, it was not available to stream. I think I just found these like bootleg episodes on YouTube or something that someone had recorded. And over time, I got to watch these episodes and get to know these characters. And I kind of felt like they were home to me. It was so comforting to kind of revisit these stories and revisit these characters on this ship who were kind of all alone as well, going on this journey, trying to reach back home to this unknown thing. So I really connected with that, and it literally like saved me in that moment. And so Kate Mulgrew, who played the female captain of that ship, I don't get starstruck too often, but she's one of the people that I would, you know, swoon over. Just I loved that character that she created for me. Was at that moment in my life really kind of saved me. And so I, you know, did some investigation into more work of hers and read her. And it turns out her real life is even more interesting with her memoirs that have come out. So to answer that question in a very long-winded fashion, Pete, I I see the connection to meaning and real life through any kind of conduit in an artistic manner.
Okay.
I hope that answers what you're questioning.
I mean, again, it's more of just kind of a subjective question. I don't think there's really a
wrong answer. I will say, before I get to your question, I will say that this podcast has allowed me to express those thoughts, right? It's allowed me to really connect to what I see in things or see in people. And I think everybody deserves for their story to be told in a really great way. And so that's another angle of this, is that ordinary people that I know have in my life that I know about, sometimes they don't really know how great they are. And I love the ability to craft their story in a way that actually is seen in a different way, that actually, okay, my life is kind of great. It is kind of cool. So that's part of it too. Yeah.
Okay. Joe, go ahead.
Real quick before I start, since we talked about animation, Star Trek, and Kate Mulgrew, are you excited for Prodigy coming out?
Yes, of course.
my friends wrote on there, and so I've been kind of getting the inside track on it, and man, that looks exciting. Kate Mulgrew is re-reprising Janeway and some animation, and that looks really great. That should be out to sometime this fall.
I was going to talk
about writers and social media and stuff like that, but then you mentioned the whole thing about younger people just being anxious and scared about getting older.
Yeah.
And so I kind of just want to say something. Take care of yourself physically and take care of yourself mentally, but don't be scared and anxious. Because the older I get, I'm not a young man anymore. I'm not as sprite as you, sir. But
you don't know how old I am, though.
I'm older.
I don't know if you realize that. The older
that I get, and I'm, like I said, I'm not a spring chicken. The more content I am with myself, and the more I know who I am, and the more I know what to love and how to love and how to make it through this world. And I am much more content now. And I wish that I had taken care of my body a little bit better, because that's not exactly doing great. That's why I tell people, take care of yourself physically, take care of yourself mentally. Therapy is a great thing. Don't think that it's something taboo to help you. And if you do those things, you don't have to be scared, because it just gets better.
How much your
ability to love gets better, and how much your outlook in the world gets better. Okay, real quick, since there's a question I want to ask, since you're into social media and stuff like that. When I was growing up, no one even knew who the writers were on the show. You know, you watched your show, you had a good old time, and that was it. You know, something you didn't like. You know, since in the advent of social media, writers, whether it's comic books, TV shows, movies, stuff like that, are now out there. They're in physical accounts. And I see a lot of times people don't kind of understand how the whole industry and whatnot works. But I see people getting like they get yelled at and stuff like, oh my God, how could you have done this to my character? Things like that. Or you guys should do this way and stuff. How do you think social media has changed as far as writers? I know writers are boring to most people in this industry, but I'm one. So how do you think social media has changed it? And how do you think writers need to handle this stuff?
Ooh, okay. I had to switch gears for a second. It is true. I mean, there are, I think a popular idea is the dark side of social media. But I'm a big advocate for finding the good way to use social media. And here's my kind of platform push about it. Social media is just a tool, like anything else. So is this pencil. It's a tool. So I can write anything with this pencil just like you can with social media. That doesn't make this pencil bad. So I think if we choose as a species and as in our human daily behavior to use our digital platforms and our devices that we have in a way that's going to be beneficial to us and to others, you can make this kind of a mindfulness practice where you ask yourself this question about what is my meaning and purpose behind what I'm doing. I struggle with that on a daily basis. I recently discovered TikTok in this past 2 years. And I almost didn't want to go down that rabbit hole. I was like, oh gosh, another platform. I remember being in my bed at night. I was like, oh, all right, I'm going to make an account. Let's just see what this is about. I'm just getting on just to see, as a social media guy, I need to know what's going on. And that was like 11 p.m. I turned it on. I looked at the clock next and it was 4 a.m. And I had just been scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. So now what I try to do is I try to do what I just talked about, is be mindful in what you're doing. So I think now's a great time and a great example for us to, when there are hot topics that you see in a tweet or something, my immediate response is to hit reply and start typing something. And normally I would just hit send. What I'm doing now is I will hit reply and, like, you know, start angry typing, and then I'll catch myself and backspace it all and delete that, because I'll ask myself these questions. Do I have a purpose behind what I'm replying to? Will it make a difference? And will it make a difference with me? And if it's no, then I just don't post it. And it's so difficult, but it also is such a relief when you get past that point. And I think what happened in our society is we were children, and someone handed us this phone with all these things on it and said, okay, go for it, without any teaching, without any rules behind it, without any sense of what it is or why we even are doing it. And that's the problem we're having, is that us as a society, we don't have any norms or social guidelines just on how we should be using those tools. So to answer your question about in the entertainment sector with writing and those kinds of things, social media has invited people to come in, comment about things that normally would have these closed door behind it. And I think, just like anything else, there's some pros and cons to that by opening the floodgates. However, let's look at this. For the first time in history, you can connect with someone that was before untouchable. And we see this with kids, especially during COVID, that have to connect digitally. They have no other choice. And so these, again, now we're talking about superheroes, you can connect with your real life superhero in a meaningful way. And you can, even just getting a message. I mean, do you remember fan mail back in the day when you actually had to, like, write a letter to something you liked?
I do all the time.
Yeah. And maybe get something back. I mean, you did when you waited weeks for it and you actually got a signature or a letter. I mean, that changed your world, man. So just think about that part of it. You know, there's a connection that you can make with something or someone, or someone that you think as a big deal. And that's hugely meaningful.
Oh yeah. I still think I have a connection with that actor's assistant who wrote that letter back to me.
Yeah. And that happens too.
Oh, well, Justin, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And Justin Conversation can be heard where podcasts are heard, right?
Yeah, and if a simple way to do it is, there's a website, justinconversation.com, and all the little platforms you can subscribe on are on there too.
And we're also going to post your information on our social media as well.
Great.
So, Justin, do you want to stick around for the final segment? We're just going to give a shout out to mom and pop stores.
I'd love to.
Okay, great. So today is National Mom and Pop Business Owners Day, and it dawned on us earlier that we don't know many mom and pop businesses left. So before we end tonight's TMI Daily, do you guys want to give a shout out to some of your favorite mom and pop stores in your community? Anybody? Joe, you have that pizza behind you.
Yeah, I'm waiting for someone else to go first.
Speaking of pizza, yeah, a friend of mine, Rob Belushi, who's an actor, he is involved with Prime Pizza. There's a few locations over Los Angeles, and they're a great mom and pop store that really do some amazing pizza. So there's that one.
Great. Okay, Pete?
Well, I mean, for us, like when we were talking about this topic earlier, my first thought was, wow, we don't know that many like small stores any longer, because it seems like everything's been taken over by the brands. Mm. But then Veronica reminded me, the hardware store down the street from us, Franklin's Ace Hardware, is privately owned by the family. Must be named Franklin because it's named Franklin's. So I'm assuming it's the Franklin family. And also Jim's Market, which is here in Woodland Hills. Some of the best cuts of beef you'll ever find anywhere. So if you happen to be in the valley and you're looking for a good butcher, go to Jim's Market.
Yeah, it's called Jim's Fallbrook.
Jim's Fallbrook Market.
Yeah, Jim's Fallbrook. That's our favorite little.
Yum.
Yeah. It reminds me of Dozie's from Gilmore Girls. Like, it's just like a small little, you know, convenience type store, but it's an actual market.
Yeah.
So yeah, so if you live in the valley, check them out. And they're just so nice there. Always very helpful. Great, great meat. Joe, what about you?
Well, definitely I got to I got to do a shout out to Vito's Pizza. Is one of my favorite pizza places here in all of LA. I think if I talk about stuff that reminds me of back in New Jersey growing up, that's great. And you know, when we talk about mom and pop stores, we talk about how we're losing some of stuff like that. One of the things that I think is still a great thing, and there's still plenty of, is of mom and pops, is when it comes to auto repair and things like that. Mm. There will always be those. I do want to do a huge shout out to Haydas Auto Electric here in LA. Those guys do a fabulous job and a real decent work for really good price. I think that's something, if you can find a good, honest mechanic to do things for you and to do it at a good price, because there's a lot of people that they're trying to go to work every day and they just don't have the money to have a new car and to keep their car running. That's really great. So not just a shout out to them, but to all the mom and pop auto mechanics out there. Hey, best to you.
Yes, and also Hank's Tires here in Woodland Hills. When we first moved here, I had a problem with one of my tires, and I took it there. I told them we had just moved to the neighborhood, and they didn't charge me at all. So I did a great deal for you for them. They're amazing, but I also want to put it out there. Hank's Tires, great mechanic.
Yeah, speaking of hardware stores, which is a great example, I just want to do a little plug. And if you notice the logo of my podcast is actually these two tin cans with the string in the middle. And that was like I have a designer that helped me dream that up, and it's such a cool idea. But it's back in that day when you really could connect with your friends, and you too can create your own tin can telephone, go to your hardware store and take all the string and the nail and do the thing. So that was also this idea that you can create your own conversation. But the hardware store, that's, you can do that now. You can still do that and have a little nostalgia with it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So again, Justin, thank you so much for joining us. And that is our show for tonight. We'll be back here again tomorrow at 6 p.m. with our guest, comedian Martin Montana. Until then, stay safe. Bye, everyone. Have a good night.
Bye.